somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakub Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation. Episode 17, Global Inquisition. Looking at the world of today, it's difficult to deny the impact of Western civilization in terms of values, culture, and political governance. What we may broadly label European Enlightenment principles have been especially successful. Even with the current democratic recession, we're still at the historical high-water mark of global democracy and freedom. But the spread of democracy and human rights is not the whole story of Western civilization. The West has also been responsible for some of the darkest chapters in human history, sometimes carried out with the indifference or even the intellectual blessing of key Enlightenment figures. And more than two centuries before the Enlightenment, a couple of European great powers exported a very different set of ideas and institutions to their colonial dominions through the globalization of the Inquisition. We've already talked about the Inquisition in previous episodes. And if you've paid attention, you'll be protesting my use of the definite article to describe it, because there was no such thing as the Inquisition. In episode 6, I dealt with what is broadly termed the medieval Inquisition, established by popes in the 12th and 13th centuries. I also briefly mentioned the Spanish Inquisition, established in 1478, to which we should add the Portuguese Inquisition, founded in 1536. And then in episode 10, I talked about the establishment of the so-called Roman Inquisition in 1542. You'll remember that the Inquisition, especially the Spanish one, has often been the target of Protestant and Enlightenment propaganda, creating a black legend, wildly inflating the numbers of casualties, use of torture, etc. But even when adjusting for the anti-Catholic propaganda, it's impossible to deny the effects of the Inquisition, because it continued into the 19th century. And although it was limping on for the last two, the Spanish Inquisition only executed its last victim in 1826, when the deist Cayetano Ripoll was hung and then burned in Valencia. Historian Francisco Betancourt estimates that across the lifetime of the Iberian and Roman Inquisitions, the lives of some 1.5 million people, including the denounced, witnesses, informants, and so on, were touched by the Inquisition, with 300,000 put on trial and around 16,000 executions. Add to this those who were tortured and given punishments like lashing, prison, banishment, and so on. And tens of thousands, mostly Jews, had to flee persecution, convert, or conceal their faith. And the effect of the Inquisition was not only costly in terms of human life, security, freedom, and dignity. It also held back science and technology. Many books placed on the index were simply lost to posterity. A Spanish study shows that between 1592 and 1682, a critical period in the history of science, 461 scientific authors were included in the index, which also prohibited, in total or partially, 759 scientific works, and 204 scientific titles were confiscated by censors. But the index was only part of the censorious apparatus in Spain. A 1634 list of confiscated books included more than 3,000 titles, 356 of which were scientific, and most of them not on the index. These works could not be reproduced, cited, discussed, or even refuted by scholars. And so it becomes clear that the Inquisition constituted a formidable instrument of social and ideological control, however imperfect its tools, method, and efficiency. And as alluded to already, Inquisition was not merely a European phenomenon. When Spain and Portugal spread their reach to the Americas, Asia, and Africa, the propagation of Catholicism and the fight against heresy, apostasy, magic, and blasphemy was an integral part of Ibero-Catholic imperialism. It touched the lives of people in places such as Mexico, Peru, Colombia, Angola, Togo, Goa, Macau, Indonesia, and the Philippines, and thus also the lives of non-Christians and non-Europeans. It is to these stories we turn now. Which means that after mangling pronunciations of Greek, Latin, Arabic, Persian, and Hindi, the time has come for me to blemish the beautiful languages of Español y Portugués. In May 1493, a papal bull declared Spanish regents Isabel and Fernando the rightful rulers of the Americas recently, quote-unquote, discovered by Columbus. But the new royal real estate came with certain restrictions and covenants. The Christian religion be exalted and be everywhere increased and spread, that the health of souls be cared for, and that barbarous nations be overthrown and brought to the faith itself. Soon, Hernán Cortés conquered the Aztec Empire and used the stones from the ruined pyramids to build a cathedral. And then the empires of the Incas of Peru and the last Mayas of central Mexico were also gobbled up by the Spanish. To justify their marauding, the conquistadors were required to read aloud the so-called Requerimiento of 1513. It explained the fine print of the papal bulls and ordered the natives to recognize the temporal sovereignty of the Spanish crown and spiritual sovereignty of Christ, or else.
The resultant deaths and damages shall be your fault and not the monarch's or mine or the soldiers.
But hey, at least they were given fair warning, right? What's that? The land was theirs and they didn't speak Spanish? Oh well. The vast American empire was divided into two viceroyalties. New Spain covered Central America and Spain's Caribbean islands. The viceroyalty of Peru covered South America. Fernando and Isabel eagerly fulfilled the Pope's demands, and according to one estimate, no less than 10 million Native Americans were converted before 1550. Conversion started out light touch, but with time it became more brutal. Native temples were torn down and replaced with churches. Sacred images were confiscated, smashed, or burned, and traditional dances and ball games were banned. Marriage, chastity, and monogamy was enforced, and native women were instructed to cover their naked bodies. The converts who didn't obey the Franciscan moral police were whipped till their backs were bloody. As one missionary put it, conversions had to be reinforced by the fear and respect which the Indians have for the Spaniards. But strict regulation of women's bodies and clothing was not enough to keep everyone's lust away. One Franciscan priest was sentenced to 6 months imprisonment after he raped a native girl and then had her arrested and flogged after she refused his continuous advances. All these brutal disciplinary sanctions had to be justified. 16th century historian Francisco López de Gomara had never met a single Indian, but still wrote that they reveled in
extremely abominable inhumaneness or sins of idolatry. They sacrificed living men. They had an appetite for eating human meat. They conversed with the devil. They practiced polygamy and, of course, sodomy.
But there was a silver lining, as he added.
The Lord's mercy had bestowed his benevolence upon the Indians, by now all Christians.
But there were also voices who protested the treatment of the Native Americans. The most famous is Bartolomé de las Casas. He used to be a colonial officer and plantation owner, but was shocked to the core by the cruel treatment of natives, whom he began defending in 1514. He argued that Jesus had not intended conversions with arms and bombardments, but with reason and human persuasion. In his famous brief account of the destruction of the Indies, Las Casas accused the Spanish of what today we'd call genocide, and put the figure of dead at 50 million. This is how he described the treatment of natives on the island of Hispaniola.
The Spaniards first assaulted the innocent sheep, so qualified by the Almighty. like most cruel tigers, wolves, and lions, hunger-starved, studying nothing for the space of 40 years after their first landing, but the massacre of these wretches, whom they have so inhumanely and barbarously butchered and harassed with several kinds of torments never before known or heard. That of 3 million persons which lived in Hispaniola itself, there is at present but the inconsiderable remnant of scarce 300.
But if you're putting your hands together for Las Casas' righteous stand, then prepare for an epic facepalm. To stop the exploitation of Native American labor on Spanish plantations, Las Casas initially suggested importing, no, not mules, but African slaves, who'd better be able to handle the dirty work. But to his credit, Las Casas ended up opposing slavery on principle, a remarkable position at this time in history. In defense of the Catholic Church, it should also be noted that as early as 1517, Spanish theologians had declared as heretical and punishable by death the very proposition that Indians were subhumans and thus incapable of faith and fit for slavery. Though that seemed to have been ignored by conquistadors, for whom religion was most useful when legitimizing rather than hindering their exploitation of the New World. Before 1570, Inquisition was local and haphazard under the ultimate responsibility of bishops and missionaries. But visitations by inquisitors from Spain were also carried out, and they might unexpectedly turn up in the New World to ensure religious orthodoxy and punish the wayward. Though still, in the 16th century, 95% of the population of Mexico had no contact with the Inquisition. So at this time, no one really expected the Spanish Inquisition. But if you did happen to cross paths with inquisitors, they were a good deal more frightening than Michael Palin, Terry Jones, and Terry Gilliam. In 1562, following a series of uprisings, the Franciscans on Yucatan discovered the Mayas were still performing pagan rituals by cleverly burying their idols of their old gods next to Christian crosses. The Franciscans also discovered that the Mayas were mocking Christ with satirical crucifixions and, according to some reports, including real human sacrifice. The Franciscans promptly set up an improvised inquisition to interrogate and torture the blaspheming Mayas. In the early 1570s, proper independent tribunals were set up in each viceroy, one in Mexico City, the capital of New Spain, and one in Lima, the capital of Peru. And in 1611, a third holy office opened in Cartagena in Colombia. With these came also the elaborate autos de fe, or acts of faith, the public ceremonies where the guilty were given their punishment and reconciled with the church, or in the case of the worst offenders, relaxed to the secular authorities for execution. And the new tribunals were barely up and running before the prison cells were filled with blasphemers, heretics, and bigamists. By 1700, the tribunal in Lima had investigated 1,176 cases, relaxing 46 culprits to the secular arm for execution, while the tribunal in Mexico City investigated 950 crimes with 59 capital punishments. The majority of trials and executions in Spanish America happened within a short but intense burst of terror between 1560 and 1640. But as we will see, moral panics relating to so-called Judaizers and later liberal revolutionaries saw renewed spikes of activity. So who were the people hauled before the Spanish Inquisition in the Americas? 20th century historian Franz Scholes writes that
the jurisdiction of the Inquisition was wide and elastic. Heresy, apostasy, blasphemy, bigamy, the practice of superstition, sorcery and demonology, propositions subversive of the faith, denial of ecclesiastical authority, lack of respect for ecclesiastical persons, institutions and censures, solicitation in the confessional, evil-sounding words, these were some of the causes for prosecution by the tribunal.
Data from historians Contreras and Henningsen show that heretical propositions and blasphemy was the primary cause for prosecution, closely followed by Judaizing, i.e. new Christian conversos from Judaism secretly reverting back to their old and forbidden Jewish ways, followed by bigamists, a crime tempting for many who had left their wife back in the old world. The crimes of Lutheranism and Islam were not tolerated either, though only 6 Muslims were prosecuted in all of Spanish America by 1700. One redeeming aspect of the Inquisition in Spanish America is that Native Americans were relatively rare targets of its activities. If you had the stomach for the occasional torture and sending people off to the stake, an inquisitor's life must have been interesting and quite varied. Some of the surviving cases deal with crimes such as claiming sexual intercourse with saints and officiating in the marriage of 2 dogs. As I mentioned, heresies and blasphemies were the most frequently prosecuted crimes. In 1572, Sancho de Aldana was convicted of blasphemy after denying the presence of the Father and the Holy Ghost in the consecrated host. Stripped to the waist, he was sentenced to declare his crimes in public with a gag in his mouth and a candle in his hand. Then he was paraded through the streets of Mexico City on a mule before he received 100 lashes and was banished for 4 years. Among the victims for heresy was a wandering hermit who had written 3 books that included erroneous doctrine. Upon his arrest in 1659, he cursed the Inquisition and was whipped through the streets with 200 lashes. But that was not the end of his punishment. He was also sentenced to be burned with his books hung around his neck. As mentioned, natives were rarely investigated by the Inquisition, but religious crimes could still be used to punish rebellious natives. In 1680, the Pueblo Indians of New Mexico instigated a large-scale rebellion and sent the Spanish colonists fleeing. The Indians destroyed the mission churches and burned all the Spanish records. But when the Spanish reconquered the land in 1693, they executed 70 Native American prisoners for apostasy. The activity of the tribunals waned in the 18th and 19th centuries, but they were nonetheless still capable of snapping into effect when new ideas became too provocative. As late as 1811, one of the heroes of the Mexican War of Independence, Miguel Hidalgo, also known as the Fox or El Zorro, was charged in absentia for, among other things, owning and reading a number of forbidden books, including a Quran and numerous classical, Renaissance and Enlightenment works. The formal accusation against Hidalgo sounds like a rant written by a religiously fundamentalist Captain Haddock. Hidalgo, a Catholic priest, was accused of being
a formal heretic, apostate from our holy religion, an atheist, materialist and deist, a libertine, seditious schismatic, Judaizer, Lutheran and Calvinist, guilty of divine and human high treason, a blasphemer, an implacable enemy of Christianity and the state, a wicked seducer, lascivious, hypocrite, a cunning traitor to king and country, pertinacious, contumacious, and rebellious to the holy office.
That's a pretty eclectic, and one would have thought mutually exclusive, mix of thought crimes. After all, being atheist, Lutheran, Calvinist, and Jewish must create some serious cognitive dissonance, not to mention the practical problems of if, how, when, and whom to worship. But what this anecdote shows is that when you have an ideological regime protecting its legitimacy with catch-all categories of thought crimes, in this case heresy and blasphemy, these crimes can be fitted to encompass anything rubbing the regime the wrong way, including secular political activities. The Inquisition was often used as a sinister weapon against personal and political enemies, including between members of the church, because every member of the church was obliged to report illegal words and actions, so it became a convenient way to solve personal vendettas. An innocent joke or a brief moment of anger or excitement could turn fatal if the wrong person listened in. When a notary wrote satirical words about a former inquisitor who still acted as if he held office, the notary was thrown in prison, tortured into disability, paraded in a public auto da fe, condemned to 300 lashes and 6 years as a galley slave. So Monty Python's portrait of the Spanish Inquisition would not have amused members of the tribunal. As you may remember, in 1492, Ferdinand and Isabel gave Spanish, or Sephardic, Jews the choice between converting to Catholicism or expulsion, creating a traumatic exodus of tens of thousands of Jews. Some fled to Portugal, only to make a second escape when the Portuguese launched their own Inquisition in 1536, or when Spain acquired the Portuguese crown in the 1580s. Some of those who left the Iberian Peninsula for good went to the New World. But persecution crossed the oceans too, and spiked in the 1590s with investigations of about 200 suspected crypto-Jews. The most famous victim of the persecution is Luis de Carvajal, the nephew of a decorated governor. The inquisitors arrested Luis on a Tuesday in May 1589. 2 days later, his lengthy trial began. Thanks to his biography, his testament, and the letters he smuggled out to his family, we know a lot of details about his case. In the eyes of the law, Luis was guilty as charged. Belonging to a family of conversos, he was raised as a Catholic, but became a crypto-Jew when he learned about his ancestral beliefs. According to his diary, he circumcised himself with a pair of scissors. Did I mention there were no anesthetics at the time? He also convinced his family to convert. Unfortunately, the inquisitors found his biography. Unwittingly, he denounced himself and his family, who were all arrested in 1595. In September of that year, Luis handed the inquisitors the document that effectively sealed his fate. It contained his signed final will, in which he endorsed his Jewish belief and condemned the kings of Spain and Portugal for always having been the root of the tree whose branches of inquisitions and persecutions have spread over the people of God, our Lord, and his holy law. He had effectively written, signed, and handed in his own death sentence. And on Saturday, December 8th, in one of the customary processions that formed a part of Autos da Fe, Luis, his mother, and his sisters were led to the great square in Mexico City together with a bunch of other sinners. The square was buzzing with spectators. The blasphemers were the first sinners to receive their sentences. They included a group of African slaves who had declared it better to be a monkey than a Christian, as the latter were lashed. Perhaps just to prove their point, the slaves were punished with even more lashes. Then came the turn of the fornicators, the witches, and the bigamists. And finally, as the grand finale, it was time for the 45 Judaizers. Luis, his mother, and his sisters received their sentences, after which Luis reportedly shouted in Latin, "Is there a worse torture in the world than for a man to have his hands tied and be surrounded by rabid dogs?" They were tied and led to the funeral pyre. Luis de Carvajal, 30 years old, was burned to death at 7 in the evening. He had just witnessed his sisters Isabel, Catalina, and his mother go up in smoke. The last sister, Leonor, went after him. A few years later, his sister Mariana confessed to her Judaism and followed the rest of the family into the flames of oblivion. A second wave of anti-Jewish persecution flared up in the 1640s. In 1640, Portugal broke off from Spain after 60 years of subjugation. The Spanish feared a Portuguese invasion of Mexico. And since many of the conversos had Portuguese roots, they were singled out for persecution. Many were denounced by relatives and friends in the clutches of the Inquisition back in the Old World. The inquisitors then gathered the information and sent it to the tribunals in Lima and Mexico. But oral evidence, such as a neighbor remembering how a suspect once years ago avoided eating pork, could also lead to arrests. In the years following 1642, the Inquisition prosecuted more than 130 conversos in Mexico. The suspects were imprisoned and interrogated, and about a third were tortured. Most confessors were expelled from New Spain, while about a handful were burned at the stake. In 1539, the Bishop of Mexico set up America's first printing office in Mexico City. It was mainly used to print basic tracts to convert Native Americans. Jesuits established Peru's first printing office in Lima in 1584. And by the 17th century, Lima had 3 printers, a university, and 5 colleges, including one for Native Americans. But from bitter experience in Europe, the church knew well the combustible nature of mixing print technology with heresy. And so censorship was a top priority for the Inquisition. When the Inquisition opened the Mexican tribunal in 1571, the first official censors, or calificadores, were appointed. Mexico's first inquisitor general launched a massive book purge in Mexico to enforce the Index of Forbidden Books, and he prosecuted and convicted unruly printers. Even Franciscans were caught with illegal books by Erasmus in their libraries. Sometimes moral panics took the censorship regime to ridiculous levels. In 1600, an edict prohibited all crosses and other sacred symbols carved or engraved or painted or embroidered on items such as furniture, bedclothing, napery, utensils, and so on, where sacred symbols might be exposed to disrespect. All such items had to be surrendered to the authorities, who then erased the symbols. This included, for instance, branding irons for cattle with a cross on them. And men with the name Jesus tattooed had 15 days to remove the offending ink. The tribunal in Lima exercised a similar kind of control. And because both Lima and Mexico were far away from Spain, these tribunals acted very independently in terms of censorship. Printers in Spanish America weren't even allowed to print fiction. Instead, novels had to be imported from Europe. That was technically illegal too. But the church reluctantly looked the other way, provided ships were thoroughly searched, and no print was allowed to get in or out of any South American port without the tribunal's minute control. After the American and French revolutions, dangerous ideas began to seep into the Spanish Empire. Fearing contamination, the Inquisition in New Mexico appointed an official censor in 1759 to keep out funny ideas. But as is always the case, there were cracks which heretical ideas could slip through. A man from California was suspected of owning a book by Voltaire. And in Mexico, a man was imprisoned after being ratted out by his mother when she found his copy of Rousseau's Social Contract. I guess that's the 18th century equivalent of finding disturbing terrorist material on your son's laptop. After all, Rousseau labeled Catholicism a bizarre religion, so clearly bad that passing the time, proving that it is so, would be wasting time. The bizarre and regressive effects of censorship became apparent as late as 1806, when after the Louisiana Purchase, the Spanish needed to delineate the border between U.S. and Mexico. But the appointed experts needed to consult works with important maps that were on the Index of Prohibited Books. When applying to the Inquisitorial Tribunal for a special license to consult these books, the request was denied. And instead, 2 calificadores were appointed to consult these dangerous works and report back to the expert. When the Spanish colonized America, they also brought homophobia. Ferdinand and Isabel had introduced torture and the death penalty for sodomy in 1497, and both native and Spanish homosexuals would be persecuted. In Panama, a Spanish explorer witnessed how a native nobleman's house was infested with the most abominable and unnatural lechery, and how the local king's brother and other younger supple men effeminately dressed in women's apparel. Therefore, he commanded 40 of them to be fed to his dogs. After doing their bid to eradicate homosexuality from the Native Americans, the colonial authorities turned on their own. The most extensive case known unfolded in the 1650s, when a network of homosexuals was discovered. After extensive interrogations, which included humiliating and nonsensical physical examinations to establish whether sodomy had occurred, the court forced a confession out of a 70-year-old man who gave up his accomplices. 15 men were burned. Only a 15-year-old boy was spared, let off with 200 lashes. When the Pope entitled Fernando and Isabel to the Americas, he divided the globe in two halves. Everything west of the line belonged to Spain. And if rivals like the Portuguese wanted to discover their own lands, they had to travel east. What no one knew was that the line cut a huge corner of South America out of the Spanish Empire. On April 22nd in the year 1500, chance brought 13 Portuguese ships to Porto Seguro on the coast of Brazil. The Portuguese king immediately contacted Fernando and Isabel to claim his new lands. In short, bad geography is the reason why Brazilians speak Portuguese and not Spanish. Of course, the Tupi living in Brazil would probably have been baffled to be informed that their lands had been discovered and now belonged to a king far away across the ocean. But during the first decades of Portuguese exploration, the Tupi were more or less left to their own device. But with permanent settlements, the relationship escalated into a state of permanent conflict. The settlers expelled the Tupi from their lands to make room for sugar plantations or enslaved them to work on them. When the Tupi attacked the settlers, the Portuguese sometimes burned villages to the ground or terrorized the Tupi into submission. When settlers were killed in Pernambuco, the Portuguese identified the guilty Tupi and crammed them into cannons to be blown to pieces in front of their families. But then the Tupi were heathens, so why not show them the light? King João III declared that
"The main reason which has led me to colonize Brazil is to convert the people therein to our holy Catholic faith."
To get the job done, João sent Jesuits. And in the 1580s, the order got competition from Carmelites and Franciscans. By the late 1700s, there were 474 Jesuits and more than 1,000 Franciscans in Brazil. To say that conversion was voluntary would not be entirely true. Much like the Spanish conquistadors, the king instructed Brazil's governor that pliant natives should be treated well, but any pagan who actively refused Christ or Portuguese supremacy were fair game for enslavement. The Jesuits didn't show a lot of appreciation for indigenous culture. The 16th century historian Pedro Gandao spent a lot of ink describing the
"multitude of barbarian heathens that nature sowed throughout all this land of Brazil, most inhuman and cruel. They were most dishonest and given to sensuality, as if they had within them no human reason."
Still, the Jesuits set out with a pragmatic strategy of tolerating most customs and traditions that didn't directly contradict Catholic dogmas. This greatly upset Brazil's first bishop, Dom Pedro Fernandes Sardinha, in the early 1550s. Under no circumstances would he tolerate nude Indians in his churches or pagans singing and dancing at Christian ceremonies. The missionaries soon realized that their task was a little harder than first expected. One priest describes how he and his colleagues arrived from Portugal expecting to convert all of Brazil in 1 hour. But given the brutishness and bestiality of the pagans, it could take a year to convert a single soul. So he concluded that little could be done since this was a kind of people more like wild beasts than rational people. When the missionaries returned to villages they'd already converted, they discovered that many of the converts had already relapsed. So they changed strategy and began to remove converts into mission villages, what the Chinese today might call re-education camps, known as aldeas, where they could keep a close eye on the natives. By the second half of the 18th century, around 50,000 native Brazilians were living in aldeas administered by Jesuits and Franciscans. The Jesuits actually adopted a critical stance on slavery of natives, similar to that of Bartolomé de las Casas. They built aldeas far away from Portuguese settlers to protect the natives from being caught and exploited. Needless to say, it didn't make the Jesuits popular with their slave-owning neighbors. In 1640, the order was expelled from São Paulo. The Jesuits were allowed to return in 1653, but only if they promised to stay out of Indian affairs. And in 1759, the order was expelled from Brazil altogether. Now, the Jesuits may have criticized native slavery, but they still profited from African slaves. In 3 centuries, around 3.5 million African slaves were shipped to Brazil. Those Jesuits who publicly criticized the hypocrisy of opposing enslavement of natives, while living on estates and running colleges relying on the labor of enslaved blacks, were repatriated. Prominent members of the church would rack their brains to come up with theological justifications for African slavery. The missionary Antonio Vieira compared Africa to hell and Brazil to purgatory. And so, the slaves were actually lucky to be shipped off to Brazil. That way, they could work their sins off and enter heaven when they died. Like the Spanish, the Portuguese exported the Inquisition to keep an eye on members of the Catholic Church of their expanding empire. The Portuguese Inquisition was launched by Papal Bull on May 23, 1536. 5 years later, João III extended the Inquisition to cover his whole empire, and the Holy Office would pry into the souls of men on four continents. The Portuguese Inquisition oversaw more than 50,000 trials and executed around 2,000 people across the empire. 1,076 of the cases were investigated in Brazil. The Inquisition mostly monitored Portuguese Catholics. Native Americans and African slaves only made up around 7% of all the Inquisition's prisoners. Unlike its Spanish counterpart, the Portuguese Inquisition didn't experience an initial burst of terror. The annual number of trials remained more or less stable. When the Spanish and Roman Inquisitions loosened their grips at the end of the 17th century, the Portuguese Inquisition only intensified its numbers of trials. Goa in India was the only colony in the Portuguese Empire to have its own independent tribunal. So Brazil remained under the tribunal in Lisbon. That meant day-to-day tasks like receiving denunciations, interrogating witnesses, and patrolling the ports for illegal books were carried out by local officials known as comissarios and their webs of assistance known as familiares. The assistants could be children as young as 10 years old. With an ocean separating the Brazilians from the tribunal, they were living in constant fear of the next visitation when inquisitors suddenly popped out of nowhere with a fresh order of arrests. On the first two visitations, more than 1,000 were denounced to the Board of Inquisitors. The Brazilians were so terrified of visitations, they would sometimes denounce dead people when the inquisitors showed up. If a denounced colonist was unlucky enough to be shipped back to Lisbon for trial, she was imprisoned, tried, and sometimes tortured in the capital. If she was found guilty, the sinner could still be kept in a secret prison for further interrogation and sometimes even more torture. Punishments ranged from spiritual penance, over-imprisonment to banishment, lashing, and penal labor in the galleys. The worst cases, the relaxados, were relaxed to the secular authorities for execution. So what could land a Brazilian in trouble? In November 1536, the Inquisitor General published a detailed description of every crime punishable by the Inquisition. And every year on the first Sunday of Lent, an updated list was read out aloud and nailed to churches all over the empire. As in the Spanish Empire, the list of crimes included Judaism, Lutheranism, Islam, heretical opinions, witchcraft, and bigamy. And only Catholics were allowed to even enter Brazil. The crime of crimes was Judaism. No less than 554, or around half of all cases, concerned Judaizing. As mentioned, many Christian converts from Judaism and their descendants fled to the Americas from the Iberian Peninsula. In Portuguese, they were known as Cristãos Novos, new Christians. While it was technically illegal for Spanish conversos to migrate from Spain, Portugal actively pushed its Jewish converts to move from the motherland into the colonies. A large part ended up in Brazil, where they were persecuted relentlessly. A total of 604 new Christians filled the inquisitorial prison cells in Brazil. That amounts to 56% of all the Inquisition's prisoners. And it took its toll. Isabel Mendes was imprisoned for Judaizing and sorcery in the late 1620s. Apparently, she went insane in prison following 7 years of grievous suffering. The visitation reports also contain a lot of blasphemy cases. Violante Fernandez, a gypsy in her 40s, was summoned by the visiting inquisitors for a remark on what must have been exceptionally bad weather. She complained that God pissed on her and wanted her to drown. Between 1590 and 1780, 119 Brazilians were accused of witchcraft or related offenses like healing, divination, shape-shifting, and pacts with the devil. As I discussed in episode 10, most of early modern Europe, both Protestant and Catholic, was gripped with paranoia and saw witches and devils everywhere. Things were less paranoid in Brazil, but orthodoxy was challenged when European folklore mingled with indigenous culture and animistic African religion in the colonial melting pot. African slaves were often suspected of magic and making pact with the devil, although there is only evidence of 37 blacks or mulattoes imprisoned by the Inquisition in Brazil. But under the Portuguese Inquisition as such, free blacks were punished much more severely than whites, including for magic, while black slaves were let off lightly so as not to deprive their masters of property. So the Inquisition also came to reinforce slavery and a racial hierarchy where free blacks were seen as a threat and left vulnerable to denunciation by whites if they stepped out of line. The most prominent example is that of Domingos Alvarez. He was born in present-day Benin in West Africa, where he worked as a healer before he was enslaved by a local ruler and shipped to Brazil in 1730. As a slave, his healing and divination business, which included mixing West African voodoo spiritualism with Catholicism, went so well that he was able to buy his own freedom. But by freeing himself from the chains of slavery, he also renounced the protection of his master and thus became a vulnerable target for the Inquisition, who suspected that his powers were the result of a pact with the devil. So he was arrested and shipped to the tribunal in Lisbon for interrogation and trial. But to the Inquisitor's great frustration, Dominguez defended himself both eloquently and consistently. So in August 1743, he was placed on a wooden rack and had leather cords tied to his arms and legs, and was warned that if he was killed or injured by the torture, the fault was his alone for not confessing his guilt. Then the executioner began turning the wheel, stretching and pulling Domingo's limbs and tearing at the tissue and muscles. Domingo's lasted for 15 minutes before crying out and confessing. That probably saved him from hearing the sickening sound of his limbs popping out of their sockets, as happened to many others. 11 days later, at an auto da fé in Lisbon, he was sentenced to public flogging and 4 years in exile for apostasy, heresy, and making a pact with the devil. But out of desperation and hunger, Domingos broke the term of his banishment, and he began healing, divining, as well as hustling again. After 3 years on the run, he was arrested and imprisoned for 15 months until sentenced to whipping and banishment in 1749. All in all, Domingos spent 10 years as a slave and 7 of his years as a free man in inquisitorial jails. White European quote-unquote witches from Portugal also ended up in Brazil after they were convicted and exiled. This included Leonor Martins. In late 16th century Pernambuco, Leonor became friends with a woman named Madalena de Calvos. The two became so close that Leonor decided to show Madalena some of her sorcery and reveal the witch's mark that was burned into her flesh. But when the visitation suddenly showed up, the friendship was put to the test, and Madalena denounced her friend. In fact, most denunciations in Brazil came from neighbors, relatives, and friends, or even personal enemies. Since the Inquisition accepted hearsay as evidence, village gossip could turn very ugly. This pattern survives in contemporary blasphemy cases in countries like Pakistan, where the Christian woman Asia Bibi was recently acquitted after spending 8 years on death row for blasphemy after a row with her Muslim neighbors. Like its Spanish and Roman counterparts, the Portuguese Inquisition imposed strict censorship. From November 1540, no book could be printed without a special license from the Inquisition, and gangs of Dominicans were sent out to make surprise raids on public and private libraries. But the inquisitorial censors weren't too busy in Brazil, because the colony didn't have a printing office before 1808. Books could only be imported from Portugal and nowhere else, and only after receiving a like from the Board of Censors. Novels were banned altogether, though there's evidence that Brazilian bookworms managed to smuggle novels into the colony. Portugal's royal family fled to Rio de Janeiro in 1808 after Napoleon invaded the motherland. The Prince Regent brought along a printing press and opened Brazil's first printing office. On the same occasion, he opened the colony's port for foreign trade, meaning that books could suddenly be printed in Brazil or imported from other countries. But the censorship was as strict as ever, and books could only be imported with the authorization from a new board of censors in Rio. And the censorship wasn't lifted before 1821, when the Brazilians won their independence from the Portuguese Empire. Even after censorship was abolished, there wasn't a very big demand for books and newspapers. In 1872, 50 years after Brazilian independence, 82% of Brazilians over the age of 5 were still illiterate. But then again, in 1867, only 10% of Brazil's school-aged children went to school. And slaves, who weren't freed until the so-called Golden Law of 1888, weren't allowed education at all. Most of Portugal's colonies were located in Africa and Asia. And one of the crown jewels was Goa, established on the west coast of India in 1510. The first Portuguese to reach India was the famous explorer Vasco da Gama in the late 1490s. Upon arrival, he declared, "I see Christians and spices." After an initial policy of pragmatic religious tolerance in India, the 1540s saw the Portuguese change tack and pursue militant conversion of Muslims and Hindus. Pagan temples and icons were ordered destroyed with the aim of ridding
the sect of Muhammad and paganism and all who are against the faith of our Lord Jesus Christ.
When in 1552 Muslims set fire to a cross erected to stop a Muslim religious festival, the culprits were promptly burned at the stake. Quite a contrast to the much more tolerant rule of the Mughal Emperor Akbar the Great, as we saw in episode 15. The Portuguese were actually not the first Christians in India, which was home to the ancient diaphysite Mar Thoma Church originating from Syria. But these schismatic heretics both had their libraries and some of their church members burned. In 1539, news reached the king of a Jewish convert in Goa who was burned to death for professing worse heresies than those of Luther and Zwingli, and there are plenty more like him in this city. And in 1546, the king was told of the need for a holy inquisition, since there are many who live under the law of Moses or follow the Moorish faith with no fear of God or shame before the world. So in 1560, the new tribunal went into business, the world's first holy office outside of Europe. A massive institution covering all of Portugal's eastern colonies, from Sofala on Africa's east coast to Macau in China and the Moluccas in Indonesia. And it was also an instrument of terror. By 1812, it had conducted around 15,000 trials. And while most records were burned, a conservative death toll of at least 200 victims seems reasonable. Most victims were alleged crypto-Hindus and crypto-Muslims who formed the majority of India's native population. Of the 3,800 cases tried during the first 62 years, 44% concerned so-called cristãos de terra, accused of paganism. In Goa, backsliding crypto-Hindus were known as rice Christians, because apparently they only converted to get food and jobs. 18% of the cases concerned Islam, while blasphemers accounted for 10% of the trials. Like Brazil and Mexico, India also became a popular destination for Jews and new Christian converts hoping to escape the persecution in Iberia. But wherever Jews or Judaizers went, so did the Inquisition. There could be no safe haven of tolerance. 9% of the Goa tribunal's victims during the first 62 years were alleged crypto-Jews. Portuguese trials of crypto-Jews were often accompanied by sermons that included anti-Semitic tropes, many of which survive among anti-Semites of all stripes to this day. Jews were plotting, scheming, greedy, and enemies of Christ. This description of Jews and Judaism is not atypical.
This disease is mortal. It has lasted for more than 1600 years. These people are paralytics, and today, in accordance with the pulse which we have taken, there's no longer any hope for their improvement.
The Portuguese Inquisition was less active in the African colonies, Angola, Guinea, Congo, Sao Tome, and Mozambique. Inquisitorial activities were concentrated in the coastal areas and predominantly aimed at European colonists, including, of course, new Christians, rather than native heathens. In Guinea, 1,800 accusations resulted in a mere 29 trials and 18 convictions, only three of which included black Africans. In Angola, only one black African was included in around 100 denunciations made during a 17th century visitation. But those Africans targeted could expect a trip to Lisbon. In 1661, an inquisitor traveled to the coast of Guinea, where he obtained a list of several accused Africans, including a woman named Crispina Perez, accused of sorcery, superstition, and worship of fetishes. Her crimes involved a ritual of palm wine and chicken blood, and a ritual blessing of her husband's ship with cow blood before travel. Crispina was arrested and shipped to Lisbon, where she waited 4 years before her trial. Only after Crispina renounced her sins at an auto-da-fé in Lisbon did she receive a mild sentence by being sent home with a warning and a set of religious instructions. In Angola, a mulatto soldier was denounced to the tribunal of Lisbon in 1715 for his illegal Mandingo charm. After a few searches, the charm was found around his waist. Convicted of unorthodox religious practice, he was sent to do forced labor in Portugal. At the end of the 17th century, the Inquisition generally lost its momentum, and its central role was further eroded in the 18th and 19th centuries under onslaught from the ideas of religious tolerance and later Enlightenment ideals of individual rights, skepticism, reason, and science, which could not be kept out entirely. In the end, the idea that social order depended on the enforcement of uniform and orthodox religious dogma to which the individual had to submit gave way. Of course, the armies of Napoleon were pretty effective too. But while the Inquisition seems a dark and distant memory, it is striking how relevant this dichotomy between, on the one hand, a tightly imposed social order, and on the other, a social order based on the rights of individual remains today, where liberal ideals of tolerance, freedom of conscience and expression, are challenged by ethno-nationalism, religious fundamentalism, and even narrow-minded progressivism. If we include medieval times, the Age of Inquisition lasted roughly 6 centuries, with ebbs and flows and shifting targets and perpetrators. Democracy, not including antiquity, has been around for some 2 centuries. But the dominance of democracy in the so-called liberal world order has only been constructed over the past 7 decades and may be fraying at the edges. Should the liberal world order collapse, might it be time for the Age of Inquisition 3.0? Thank you very much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stehøj, and Matthias Meyer contributed with essential research. Please remember to share and like and leave a review on iTunes.